How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez and Dave Meltzer here on Wrestling Observer Radio. It is May 8th, 2012 here at figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. We got a lot of news to talk about today, so let's not waste any time. Dave, first off, how you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Not too bad. Doing better than Dominic Cruz, who tore his ACL on Saturday.
He tore his knee up on Thursday, actually.
It was Thursday.
But they hit it on Ultimate Fighter on Friday. They never mentioned it because at the time they hadn't gotten the diagnosis back, so they were just hoping that it was nothing that they needed to talk about. But in fact, on Saturday they found out that it was something that they needed to talk about, and I guess it kind of snuck out today before they I don't know when they were going to make the announcement. I'm guessing they probably wanted to hide the announcement until Friday and announce it on the show itself. And I guess that's going to be a focal point on Friday's Ultimate Fighter is everything that happened and exactly what they're going to do, which they haven't announced. The theory is that they'll probably have Faber against somebody for the interim title. I think they almost have to, and it's probably either Henan Barrow or Michael McDonald. I'd like to see Michael McDonald, but Henan Barrow is probably more likely just because he's already booked on the July 7th show anyway. He was supposed to fight Ivan Menjivar on that show, so they could easily move him up. And I thought that McDonald's a slightly better known, but it's, I guess they're probably at the same level as far as known. But McDonald beat Miguel Torres, which I thought was like a bigger name. Not that Barrow, has beaten Jorgensen. I think he beat Jorgensen. But it'll be one or the other, and mostly like Barrow for the interim title. And then actually it's going to be tough to get Faber and Cruz, because I'm presuming that the winner would have one more fight, which would probably be against the odd man out. So if it's Barrow, it would be against McDonald most likely. And then after that, then you're going to have Cruz returning, and the odds of Faber winning both those fights are not very high. I wouldn't favor him against Barrow either way, but it's possible. And so the only way you're going to get Faber and Cruz is for either Faber to win two fights against really tough guys, or for Cruz to come in and have whoever the champion is beat Cruz. And then at that point, they could probably do Faber and Cruz. Probably would do Faber and Cruz by then. Not that, how big it would be by that point, I don't know. He tore his ACL, probably going to have surgery, probably going to be out for a long, long time, and that's the deal, and it's too bad. I guess Faber was on Inside MMA tonight, and, was real sad about it, just wish the best for Cruz, and kind of all that work kind of down the tubes for at least temporarily.
Do we know what happened, how he heard it?
I don't know exactly how he heard it, but I was under the impression that they have footage of it, of him hurting it. It was in training, with his team, and that the footage would be on the air on Friday.
Do we have a final number for Fox?
No, that won't come until tomorrow.
All righty. Well, we'll discuss that next couple of days then. Raw.
It's not going to be good.
Well, no, we knew that.
Yeah, it's going to be a real bad number. I guess Dana Stone's on Twitter, so he hasn't jumped out any windows or anything like that.
Well, that's good. That's good.
So he said between that and then the thing this morning,
Cruz. This sucks. The reason this sucks the most of all is because, no one's watching this season, but the people that actually are watching this season, now they're not even getting a payoff in the coaches' fight.
Hey, there's still 900,000 people who are watching week after week.
Yeah, so for those people that are actually investing in this season, that really sucks for them. But the fact that this is on the show that features Sonnen and Silva, I don't think this is badly hurting the pay-per-view, if it affects it even at all.
Not much, because you're still going to get a championship fight out of it with Faber. So I think that it's not going to be a major difference. It hurts the card a little bit. But The thing is, I'm wondering what happens with the season, in the sense of, okay, we've got several weeks left. If you remember when Tito Ortiz got hurt, they brought in Rich Franklin. It was only for like a week to replace him. They kicked him off the show basically because he wasn't going to do the fight. And so, do they bring in Barrow, which is who doesn't speak English? Do they bring in McDonald? Do they just, you know, what do they do as far as the coaching? That's another issue.
I say they bring in Burrell and have Cruz be his heel manager.
That's actually not the worst idea if you could do it that way, but yeah. And then you've got the storyline of, you know, they're not going to do that, though.
No.
You could do the storyline then of Burrell turning on Cruz, or Cruz, him winning the championship and then Cruz hitting him with the chair afterwards, right?
That's right, yeah. Set up the title match down the road.
Set up the match when Cruz is ready.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of ways they could go with this, and they won't.
If it was WWE, they would do it. They would do it backwards.
Well, you know, they did bring in Paul Heyman on Raw. And I just watched it and I thought, you know, I know we've talked about before, like, with a guy like Ric Flair, like, you could never really make a movie about Ric Flair because no one could actually play Ric Flair like Ric Flair.
They were going to make a movie about Ric Flair, except Ric Flair backed out of being involved because he wanted such a big advance.
Yeah.
But I know. You really, whoever played like Ric Flair in the movie, it'd be
impossible.
Horrible. It'd be horrible because it could never be Ric Flair.
And in the same way, the comparison here with Paul Heyman, when he came out to play the legal counsel of Brock Lesnar, when he walked out of the ring after his promo, I just thought, you know, there's no man on the face of this planet that is better suited to play the legal counsel of Brock Lesnar. I thought Heyman was awesome on this show.
Oh, well, he was just Heyman. He was exactly what you'd expect. I mean, he should have been with him. He should have been with him from week one.
Yeah.
I mean, by now he'd had so much heat and... I mean, let's face it, there's nobody who understands the Lesnar character and how to, you know, what to do with it than Heyman. I mean, that's, you know, that's obvious. I knew that going in that, you know, I mean, that's the one thing. He understands exactly what to say. You know, I was, as soon as he went out there, I said, he's going to nail this thing perfectly.
And
because
he did.
He knows exactly, he knows the story that they should do, and he knows how to get that story over, and... the crowd, like, didn't even know who he was. I won't say, like, everyone didn't know who he was, but from texts that I got from inside the building, they were, you know, the crowd doesn't know who this guy is at all. So apparently most people did not know him. But
that's fascinating, the new audience we've got nowadays.
They knew Lesnar, though, which is funny because they both were on TV at the same time.
Well, Lesnar's been doing UFC.
Yeah, but they knew Lesnar's music, if you remember.
Yeah.
Well, you know what, though? That's also a different audience. That's the WrestleMania audience. If Heyman had showed up at WrestleMania, everyone would have known who he was there,
sure.
Too. This is a different audience.
Yeah.
Greensboro Coliseum audience is just, you know, a lot of Cena fans. The place was loaded with Cena fans. Who did get to see John Cena because he miraculously, after being banned from the building and being in Florida, managed to make it to Greensboro in time for the dark match with Kane and Pin Kane.
Amazing how that works. With one
arm.
Yeah,
and no sling.
How about that?
Yeah. You know, I tell you what, I really noticed this with frickin' when Sheamus comes out there with his shoulder all taped up, and I'm going like, you got John Cena, Sheamus, and Triple H, and they're all frickin' got the same injury.
Yep.
It's like you talk about, I mean, just never in wrestling could that have ever happened. I mean, you would never just duplicate it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, in football, three guys can have knee injuries on the same team. So it's not like it's fake, but it's just like it's like typical. You know what they have an idea, so then they do it for everyone all at the same time.
Actually, well, I guess technically it's an arm and two shoulders.
Yeah, but everyone's arm and shoulders are taped up,
which is funny because we've got Triple H who has a. I guess a sling when he needs to have a sling, but not when he doesn't. And then he claims he did when he didn't. And then you've got Cena that has a sling, but then wrestles without a sling. And
then doesn't go anywhere with a sling.
That's right. This whole thing is just...
You've got Triple H with that mechanical device that you take off, because it's and it gives you a full range of motion even with a broken arm, that was just freshly broken.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's very complicated, Dave.
Yeah, I know. He did say that.
It's very complicated,
it's
this device.
It's a very complicated injury. It's a break and more, but even with a break and more, you still can, you know, you still have full range of motion in that arm.
It's incredible the things they can do with medical technology nowadays.
Something like that, yeah, yeah. Who was somebody else that had that injury this week? I'm trying to remember now. Oh, well, doesn't matter.
John Laurinaitis came out and started a show, talked about how he's still the GM, he's still in charge, the board had done nothing. This was explained later, by the way. Said that when he lost his temper, he went into a fit of destruction that nobody could withstand. I thought that line was hilarious, delivered by John Laurinaitis.
I loved when he signed Brock Cena, too.
He is such a bad talker.
But I think it's really good, though.
It's I don't even know how to really explain it. It's like he's so, in some ways he's so bad at his job, yet he's so awesome at the same time. It's incredible that the, I don't know what it takes, talent or a lack of talent or a little of both.
He doesn't have a lack of talent. That's not it. It's what it is that he's tremendously smug, and that works, and that, you know, he's got that fake corporate thing that everyone can relate to, but at the same time, the guy, you know, like when he memorizes his promos,
absolutely horrible at it.
The one thing, no, he's not really that bad at it, but you can always count on him forgetting something in every promo.
Not in every promo, but like in every paragraph of every promo.
Okay.
If you watch like the Paul Heyman interview and then come back and watch John Laurinaitis, I mean, I think it's
Heyman doesn't forget.
No, it's the standards of wrestling nowadays. People look at Laurinaitis and they're like, guys, you know, he's fine. But like 15 years ago, this guy would be like the worst promo of the year.
No, there were a lot. There were guys back then that were terrible promos. There were a lot of guys that were bad promos. You don't remember them because so many of the guys, the good promo guys, were you know, so good. But
But a guy that's like, getting a good 10 minutes of speaking time on a show every single week,
well, nobody
a show.
I mean, even Ric Flair and Dusty never had to talk like these guys had to talk forever and ever and ever.
No.
So it's just a totally different thing. But no, I mean, you had like, I mean, there were guys on top. I mean, Robert Gibson, Jay Youngblood. I mean, those guys couldn't talk to save their lives.
Yeah, but I'm talking about a main event star level guy that's there every single week.
Jay Youngblood was a main event star. Robert Gibson was a main event star.
Hmm.
You know, there are plenty of others like that. I mean, if I, you know, thought back on, you know, the guys from that era, you know, a lot, Devon Eriks. I mean, Kerry Von Erich.
Well,
that guy couldn't even string together a sentence. And I mean, and he was Jimmy Snuka. Ultimate Warrior. These guys were terrible.
Yeah, well, it's kind of Warrior's gimmick that he spoke a different language.
Oh,
than
Ultimate
everybody
Warrior!
Else.
Did you hear about Ultimate Warrior and his bicep surgery and everything?
No.
Okay, this guy. He Ultimate Warrior is the greatest because Ultimate. Okay, he had you know, he tore his biceps about a month ago and had surgery. So he's doing this. He posted some video again, and he's talking about how, you know, all those people, the doctors, the rehab people, they're all idiots. They don't know anything. And it's like he, you know, was told that, you know, he had surgery, so keep your arm in a sling for however long, and then, you know, go to rehab and do this, this, and this. So he just said, like, you know, I threw the sling away on the way home and started doing curls with surgical tubing. And, like, now he's up to, like, 35 pounds on the bad arm doing curls. And I'm just thinking, and he's, like, just going, that, you know, like, these doctors are so stupid, and I'm thinking, like, he's probably roiding up, you know, so he's healing quicker, but he still just had surgery, so his odds, I mean, it's like, you know, he may come out of this okay, but if this guy, I mean, think about this. I mean, remember when Dave Bautista had the tricep surgery, and he re-tore, I mean, he's not the only one. I mean, what's his name, Del Wilkes, same way, where these guys, I mean, they took time off, and they still re-tore that freaking tricep because, you know, you come back after a surgery like that, and biceps is the same way. You go in there and it's like, yeah, you know, you great, he's out there and he's just going like, I could curl 35 pounds, strict form squeeze at the top. Basically, he's doing all the things the doctors tell him not to do, and he's making fun of the doctors for being stupid. And I'm thinking, like, you know, you're the one who's stupid, because you may go and tear that thing again because you're not listening to the doctors while you're out there saying that doctors are so stupid that, you know, they don't understand, especially when you're like 53 years old. You know, I mean, you know, if you're 25, maybe you can get away with it. But 53, I'm not saying you won't get away with it at 53, but, you know.
The odds are slim.
The odds are slim. Plus, if he is doing stuff like that after surgery, it even increases the odds of re-tearing the thing. So anyway, that was Ultimate Warrior story.
So Laurinaitis is talking about no scene on Raw. He's going to have an interview later on with Michael Cole. He's going to apologize for making fun of Laurinaitis' voice. says that anybody from this point forward who makes fun of his voice is going to be punished severely. And he...
Cena didn't apologize, did he?
Who?
Did Cena apologize?
I don't know. I don't think he did on the big screen, actually. He had more important things to talk about.
No, he never apologized. Big Show kept apologizing over and over.
That's right. Well, the show was rewritten 84 times this afternoon, so...
Yeah, that's true. They could have had that one segment and then forgot to tell Cena to do the other segment.
Yeah. So he talked about how Steve Williams, Dr. Death, had injured his voice or injured his neck or something.
Vocal cords. I don't know that that's true.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I remember John Laurinaitis always talked like that.
So he talked about how he was a huge star over there. He was bigger than Hogan, Austin, or Rock. All rolled into one.
And yeah, that was pretty funny.
Said his match with Cena would be bigger than Rock versus Cena at Mania or Brock versus Cena at Extreme Rules. Good luck with that one. So out came Punk, and he did a promo that would be difficult to fully recap since he seemed to forget half of it. That's
weird for him because he's usually pretty good with that stuff.
Yeah. Eventually, he actually asked at one point, have I forgotten anything? And he had.
How would we know?
I don't know. Maybe he was hoping Laurinaitis would remind him of what he'd forgotten, but...
that's like Laurinaitis is trying to keep track of his own stuff.
Exactly. Laurinaitis couldn't remember.
He's not listening to what Punk's saying.
So he did his promo and talked about Laurinaitis being a joke and called him ugly, stupid, a toolbox, this and that. Said that if he wasn't training, Laurinaitis said, if I wasn't training, I'd kick your ass right now, and signed him to a match with Lord Tensai later in the show. So there you go.
That was a challenge.
Just this weekend, they were discussing that match for SummerSlam.
Yeah.
After this match on Raw, I don't know if I expect that match at SummerSlam.
I don't know if I would either.
We had Laurinaitis bumping in a Big Show, at which point Show made fun of his voice, and then Eve saw this, so trouble was coming. We had Big Show beat Cody when Cody just walked out.
In a minute.
Yeah.
Where was that nothing? That was just a setup for those guys on that, I think it's Common Law, is that the name of the show?
Oh, the USA show, yeah.
Yeah, the two guys from Common Law, like at the end of the show, this whole thing was set up so they could tell jokes about Cody running away.
So after he ran away, Eve came out and she demanded an apology, and Big Show gave a half-ass, actually it wasn't even a half-ass, it was no apology. So she indicated that he was tall, old, and fat, which is...
I was amazed that they...
mentioned 40?
They gave his real age.
Yeah.
Because, he's been around for a long time, but, 40, to say in a wrestler's 40, it's kind of like telling you that he's kind of like at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And especially for him, I was put it this way. That whole segment, when it was over... It was like, talk about, like, emasculating a baby face. I mean, people do this all the time in modern wrestling. But, I mean, when that thing was over, it was like, they made him look like the biggest pussy in the world. Like, a loser, couldn't get a job. Instead of, like, he's such a big star. Like, you would want people to think that your stars are stars. Instead, they made it like, this guy, if this guy didn't have the WWE, he'd be on the unemployment line because there's no work he could do because he's too old and too big to do anything.
And apparently untalented.
I don't know. Did you say he was untalented?
Well, if he can't get a job anywhere, he's an entertainer. You'd think he'd get a job in entertainment.
Yeah, you would think.
Anyway, he was so sad about this and apparently realized that, in fact, he was old and tall and had no skills.
God, at least he could have done it and say, look, I'm a movie star. I starred in the movie Knucklehead.
That's right.
Yeah.
But he didn't.
That nobody saw.
He apologized.
Yep. WWE movie star that stars in a movie is, in fact, someone who cannot get work elsewhere, which I guess is kind of true.
It is kind of true.
Yeah.
Dolph beat Kofi pretty quickly, actually. Zigzag finish. We had Primo and Epico out there. And,
they weren't out there. They were backstage watching.
Watching, yes.
Yeah, with AW and...
And Mason Ryan.
And Mason Ryan, who's going to be... who knows? Mason Ryan, over the weekend, was being tested as Dolph Ziggler's bodyguard at the house show. So that may be something that they do, that they end up doing. So they've not given up on Mason Ryan, as it appeared they had.
Seen it in his big interview on the big screen. Said that he had his elbow drained several times a day, but despite the doctor saying he should take a few months off, he was medically cleared and he was going to wrestle at the pay-per-view.
That really was confusing, wasn't it?
That was something else.
Yeah, I mean, because first he says he's medically cleared, and then he says that the doctors, he's not listening to the doctors. It's like, well, they cleared you.
Well, they recommended that he should take some time off.
Okay, but they cleared him.
Well, yeah.
So there you go. They cleared him. They wouldn't clear, you know, whatever, Beth Phoenix, who's probably healthy right now.
Well, apparently she is because she's
actually, she was cleared,
title shot
during the week, and then she was uncleared.
Yeah.
When they change their mind on the stories or whatever they do.
Said the reason the board of directors didn't contact John Laurinaitis was because they contacted Cena, and Cena told them, do not do anything to this man, especially fire him, until after Over the Limit.
Okay, so now, here's the thing. So after Over the Limit, did they then fire him?
I guess they can, unless he wins. I don't know. I presume that Cena beats him and Laurinaitis disappears for a month, and then he comes back and they totally forget all of this.
I don't think he's going to be gone for a month. I think Cena will beat him, but I don't think he'll be gone for a month. I think he'll be back the next day on Raw.
So Cena kind of buried Laurinaitis.
Yeah, I figure, you know, outside interference, Blower Tenzai runs in or 10 other guys run in. Who knows?
Well, then Laurinaitis could win.
Yeah, it's possible, too.
God, can you imagine that? Cena beats Brock Lesnar, but...
Actually, I would probably favor Laurinaitis now that I think about it.
Oh, my God.
Because if you think about it, like, remember when Jonathan Coachman was going to wrestle Steve Austin? Coachman was supposed to win that match, except Austin decided to no-show.
Well, I think that was kind of a way to humiliate Austin, and I don't think they're looking to humiliate John Cena.
No, but it's just kind of the way they think.
Well, yeah. Layla and Kelly beat Maxine.
If you're sure that he's not going to win, then they got to do the opposite.
Layla and Kelly beat Maxine and Natalya. There
was quick.
A lot of Maxine in this match. God knows why. But it was quick, thankfully, and Layla pinned Maxine, so.
There it was no harm. It was only a minute match.
It was short.
Yeah, I didn't see any botched spots or anything.
We had Jericho and Alberto Del Rio beating Sheamus and Randy Orton. The big spot at the end is Sheamus went for the brogue kick and accidentally hit Orton, laid him out. Jericho hit Sheamus with the Codebreaker and pinned him. And then afterwards, Orton gave Sheamus the RKO as revenge. So we had, eventually later on, a giant brawl in the office of John Laurinaitis. Babyfaces end up clearing the ring of... the office of Jericho and Alberto Del Rio. All had demanded a championship match against Sheamus, and so John Laurinaitis decided the pay-per-view is going to change the title match. It is now Jericho, Del Rio, Randy Orton, and Sheamus for the title. Yeah, four-way. I guess they needed these dudes on the show or felt that Sheamus and Alberto Del Rio was not a money match or whatever the deal was. But now it's
just
a four-way.
Whatever the deal, I think they just felt they need to strengthen the card.
Yeah.
And, you know, that Orton and Jericho were odd men out at the card, at, you know, going in. So now they're figured in. And who knows? I mean, you know, one of the things, again, with this was supposed to be, the whole idea for, you know, was that Sheamus was going to get that, you know, the 18-second win, and he was going to explode, you know, as a super babyface. And that hasn't happened, partially because the 18-second win sort of it just completely backfired. So who knows? Maybe they're going to go back to Orton. You know, I mean, Orton's still the most popular guy on the SmackDown brand. Or I don't think they'll go with Jericho since Jericho's leaving pretty soon. You know, so they could go with Del Rio, I suppose. I don't know if that was the plan originally, but who knows?
We had Laurinaitis and Eve prior to this, by the way, talking about Big Show. And not impressed with his apology. So Eve went to solve this problem, which, by the way, never got solved, actually.
Well, I think she scolded. She was there while he was making fun of Laurinaitis again, so I figured this is probably going to pay off maybe tomorrow or next Monday.
We had Brodus Clay versus The Miz, and this match went on way too long. And it was,
yeah, you know, I mean, you really could, the thing with Brodus Clay is that when he doesn't do that pattern match, he really gets exposed, and that's the all. You know, they were like 90 seconds in, and I'm going like, oh my god, it's like he's being exposed right now.
Alan, it was just like Miz just kept throwing these kicks, and this was not good.
And I'll tell you what the other thing was, is I'm watching this, and all I could think of is, you know, of all the decisions they've made, and I know that they've made decisions far worse than this, but one of the worst is the Miz as the star of the Marine. I mean, I'm just looking at this going like, do they realize, like how, like, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, the Miz as the star of the Marine, it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of.
It's,
well, no, it's not. Beating Brock Lesnar was stupider, but still.
In terms of starring roles in the movie division, this one's at the top.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, he lost here, by the way, to a big splash after, I believe, one headbutt and an exploder.
Yeah.
That was Clay's entire comeback. So, obviously, they're getting ready to get Miz off TV for a while to film this movie in June. But this did absolutely nobody any favors, this particular match.
No, they tried to, you know, have Clay go a little bit longer and, you know, more serious, and it worked in reverse.
Brodus Clay, to me, when he does, if he's going to do a longer match, he's got to do it kind of like, it's going to sound like a bad comparison, but bear me out, Undertaker. We're like, Undertaker.
That's a really bad comparison.
Well, I'll tell you why. Undertaker, when he's going to do a match, Undertaker will, like, take offense for, like, 10 straight minutes, and then he'll sell for, like, 2 minutes, and then he'll do his big comeback, near falls, and win. You never see the deal where, like, Undertaker, I mean, maybe with a Brock Lesnar or something like that, but with your average guy, Undertaker's not going to be in there, you know, selling for 10 minutes straight. And Brodus Clay selling for 80% of this match was death. You know, he should have taken the first 2 minutes, sold for a minute, and then made his comeback and won. It's just way too much laying there on the mat taking kicks.
The other thing was he did an inset. Like, it was one of those, like, 1980s inset deals.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Oh, was that telling everyone, you know, to, you know, this weekend's
call
Mother's
your mama.
Day or something?
Call your mama for Mother's Day.
Oh, was that? I thought that, you know, I mean, he was doing so well. And it's like, boy, was that lame. Now we know that he can't talk, which we didn't know before. Or, oh, it was... I mean, you know what? He may actually be able to talk for all I know, but boy, was that material horrendous.
Heyman came out. Paul Heyman. And he talked about Lesnar and talked about how he'd be an unappreciated man from day one. And said that Lesnar was honest. Came in, said he was going to hurt people. He beat a bunch of people up. Said he had a statement that he was going to read from Brock. And it basically said that Brock had come back to bring legitimacy to the company. He was greeted with corporate BS. He said Hunter broke his agreement, his demands that he had made.
His reasonable demands.
Reasonable demands, yes, reasonable.
Yeah, that he'd negotiated.
So Triple H broke the agreement, so he broke Hunter's arm. Lesnar did not care about anybody, the people, the fans. And thus, he was never coming back. He was quitting. And then Heyman walked out. And as noted, Heyman did a fabulous job with his material. And I guess Lesnar's gone till the summer.
He's gone until he's back.
Which is interesting, actually, because Hunter is going to make his first official statement next week.
Yes.
Which... I don't know what he'd have to say if the dude's fired. I presume he's going to say that
wants him unfired.
This man has been signed to a very lucrative deal. He cannot walk out or he'll be sued, and so he must...
Oh, my God. They're going to do a lawsuit thing where he backs down, since in the real life it would happen the other way. That's awesome.
Yep. He's
oh my God.
Required
only
to come
only
back.
In WWE. Well, I don't know if they're actually going to do that, but that would be WWE.
Required to come back and face Hunter at SummerSlam.
Yeah.
Then we had the Big Show deal where he was laughing with the dudes, and Eve Torres came up and gave him the mean look. So, next week.
They were laughing at because the guys from Common Law were making fun of John Laurinaitis, which means that
Now they're in trouble.
They need to apologize.
They'll have to apologize.
Or they're going to be kicked off the USA Network.
I think like in the middle of the television show, they should just, have Eve walk onto the set and then they can do their apology and break character and then just go right back to it again.
Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah.
That's usually how you do good drama television shows.
Yeah, like in pro wrestling, you know?
Yeah, you follow pro wrestling. Yeah, exactly. And don't do it.
Daniel Bryan and Lord Tensai ended up facing CM Punk. Now a handicap match. And Punk got beaten up for a long time. Tried a GTS on Tensai. That, of course, failed. They tried a Baldo bomb, and boy, did they botch that spot. And then hit the claw.
How do you botch that spot?
Well, someone either didn't jump or...
I don't know. But, I mean, even if you didn't jump, I mean, I would think that, well...
Well, the idea is when...
You know what? He probably jumped too early.
When Tensai lifts the guy, Punk needs to use his knees and kind of wrap him around Tensai to hold himself up for a second for the dramatic effect. That did not occur. So Tensai just lifted him and he fell down. Then he did the claw with the green mist. And 1, 2, 3. Lord Tensai pinned CM Punk. Still not over a lick.
We should call this the librarian death match.
This was met with silence. Nobody cares about Tensai. He's beaten John Cena. He's beaten CM Punk. Nobody cares. And afterwards, Brian put Punk in the yes lock to set up their match at the pay-per-view. And there you go. Thought the Heyman stuff was great. I thought the tag match was pretty good.
Tag match was all right. Yeah, it was good. Other than that, it was just there. I didn't think anything was like sucking bad. I mean, like, but you know, it was. I would say it was like as a show, it was slightly above average. No, well, it was average. Average, except for the Heyman interview. Really, the main event was death, though.
The main event was pretty bad. Yeah, it was pretty bad. We have New York Assembly will not be voting on the bill to legalize and regulate MMA again. So at least
I tell you what, the New York politics looks so bad through the way this whole thing goes down. Did you hear? You know, hear what happened?
He does not believe that there's going to be enough people to vote or to.
Right. Well, yeah, that's what he said. He said like there weren't enough votes to. They had a closed door meeting, and he determined that there were not enough votes. They let people speak on both sides. You know, like the people for the legalization of MMA and the people against legalization of MMA, and they let them both speak. And then when it was over, he did a quick vote and said, like, you know, if all those like in favor, raise your hand, and about 25 people raise their hand, and all those not in favor, you know, whatever. And, you know, in favor, all those in favor of killing the bill and all those not in favor of killing the bill, you know, raise your hand. And about 60 people raised their hand. So he said he determined now that those numbers were the numbers of somebody else who was in that room. One of the other legislators, an upstate New York legislator whose name was not revealed because they were speaking out of turn, but said that it appeared to them that it was about 60 people wanted it, and 25 didn't. And he said that he thought it was about even, and somehow, even when you would think if it's even, that you'd want to bring it to a vote. But it said, so he determined that it didn't have enough votes to pass, so why even bother? And then when it was brought to Sheldon Silver's attention that somebody said it was like 60 to 25, he said, well, you know, there's people who weren't in the room who I've spoken to, and they were pretty negative. So that was what he said.
That's a lot of people he must have spoken to.
Yeah, so Mark Ratner said that this was un-American, that at the very least, it should have gotten a vote, and it didn't even get that. And it's amazing. It's just amazing that this actually happened. I'm not shocked, because I kind of was expecting it, but it is still amazing.
Well, there's always 2013.
Yeah, so they're going to be out of the... So no John Jones match at the Garden at the end of this year.
Oh, boy. So there you go, everybody. That's the New York story there. Talk a little bit about the founder of Gong Magazine, who has passed away.
Yeah, Kosuke Takeuchi, who founded Gong Magazine when he was like, 21 years old, 1968, which was, I was trying to like explain who he would be and say he's like the Bill Apter, but that's not really strong enough because Takeuchi was a guy who like came right out of high school and started working for boxing and wrestling magazines for baseball magazine Shaw, and then he switched. He was there for a couple of years and decided that he was going to publish his own magazine and started the Gong Publishing Company, which ended up doing a lot more than just professional wrestling. It actually did tons of different magazines, and actually last year or two, you know, they actually dropped the pro wrestling magazine, but he was long gone by that point. But so he was the head of Gong and a very major figure in Japanese wrestling from, I would say, the mid to late 60s up until, you know, probably 5-6 years ago. And he was in the 70s, he was the he did the color commentary for the International Wrestling Enterprises promotion, which was like the number 3 group in Japan. And then in the 80s and 90s, he was announcing for All Japan, which is where, you know, he was most famous. And he was known for, you know, knowing everything about the foreigners. He was really good at explaining who the guys were, especially it wasn't as big a deal in the late 80s because it was the same foreigners, you know, and in the 90s especially, it was the same foreigners month after month. But in the 70s, when you had different people in on every tour, he was very valuable, you know, in saying who these guys were, where they came from, you know, stuff like that on television and kind of getting them all over. And then the magazine was, Gong Magazine was always very, what's it called, foreign influence. You know, a lot of stuff on Lucha Libre, more than Weekly Pro, because of Thomas Shimizu, who he had hired. When he came in, Takeuchi was a big supporter, he was really into the Madison Square Garden and the Olympic Auditorium in Los Angeles. So it was monthly Gong in those days. It was before there was weekly. And monthly Gong would be more sensationalized, like Weekly Pro, which was the other magazine, which was actually was called Wrestling Monthly, I think, or Monthly Pro Wrestling before it became Weekly Pro. They were more, I guess they would be more legitimate news, and the Gong was more kind of like character, you know, overplaying the characters like the Funks and Dick Murdoch and, you know, like that, you know, like more comedic and more colorful and things like that, and more fake, as you know. And he was against the going weekly because he felt that the monthly, you could use your imagination and do all these fake stories, and you go weekly, you're going to sell a magazine weekly, you're going to have to do like real news. And he didn't really want to do that, but in fact, the world changed and he did that. And Weekly Gong was, you know, Weekly Gong was very, very successful for a long time. And when Japanese wrestling was big, it was hugely successful magazine, and he was on the TV shows, and he recruited so many guys that I know, Koichi Yoshizawa, Wally Yamaguchi, Jimmy Suzuki, Thomas Shimizu, several others, you know, all of the big names. They were all actually, as kids, those guys. Takeuchi was like, the word where he was like Bill Apter was, they were both big fans of Mel Moskaris. And I think that when you have a monthly magazine in the late 60s and in the 70s, Mil Moskaris, because of the physique and because of the colorful mask and the capes and the flying still pictures, it must have been something about him that you know, caused people to buy magazines or the magazine editors to gravitate towards him, because you had the number one magazine in the United States, you know, was so influenced, you know, so always pushed Mil Moskaris, and as this, you know, on the covers and stuff like that. And in Japan, it was the same thing. And actually, Mil Moskaris was a superstar in Japan before he ever even went to Japan. You know, so it's a lot of people think like he went over to Japan and got over big. He was actually over big because of the still photos of him doing all the flying stuff from the Olympic Auditorium that predated his arrival by several years. So when he first came in, it was like a big thing. And he was a hero to the kids, and the guys who are doing the Mil Máscaras, like, fan club, you know, like teenage guys. I mean, I've seen, like, the videos of these guys when they were all, like, I don't know, like 13, 14 years old, you know, all dressed up, like, with their Mil Máscaras masks and everything with the Mil Máscaras fan club. And it was like, oh, my God, all these guys were the guys who ended up being, you know, the number one, you know, the top magazine guys, you know, years later. He, like, hired them when they were all very young, and they all became top editors, and they were, you know, in that era when I started going there in the 80s in Japan, those guys, they were like a big freaking deal, those magazine guys. I mean, the magazine guys had tremendous power. They took care of the wrestlers because the wrestlers loved the exposure. And, I mean, you just had to be there to see the power that these guys wielded. And he was the number one guy. And I remember, you know, I met him many, many times. And, you know, just, you know, whatever. He was, I mean, he was a real, you know, big, you know, proponent as far as, like, the awards in the Observer. He was the one who always, you know, put them in, big stories every year. So, you know, at the time in the 80s, because this would start in the 80s, that was incredible exposure. You're in something that's, you know, that's in a circulation of several hundred thousand people. You know, eventually the newspapers covered him and stuff like that. But he was the first one to do that. So, you know, but he had suffered a stroke in 2006 and had been pretty much, you know, out of it since then. I mean, no one had seen him or anything like that. And he passed away on Thursday. They had the funeral. Everyone who's anyone in Japanese wrestling sent flowers, and many, many, you know, the biggest superstars, you know, from going back to the 70s, the ones who were still alive, everyone was either there or represented in some way, shape, or form. So, yeah, he was a big, big deal in Japanese wrestling for a long, long time, for, you know, almost 40 years.
Let's do some of the questions here. This person says, I was wondering if there's any long-term plan for the Bushwhackers back in the 80s and 90s. Or they're solely there for comedy purposes?
They were solely there for comedy purposes.
So Vince just found it entertaining?
And they had the idea and, you know, worked for them at the time, yeah.
Hmm. Reading in Brett's book about his first meeting with Dave, he describes Dave as polite and nervous. Brett implied he was not thrilled about meeting him. Could Dave briefly describe his side of the first meeting and whatever became of Averno signing with WWE?
Averno has been on hold, you know, because of Sin Cara, you know, flaming out and getting hurt. So as far as Bret Hart, the first time I met Bret Hart, as I recall, I thought that he was actually the one nervous because, well, I mean, he wasn't that nervous, but he was sitting at a bar with a mutual friend of mine, and I kind of walked in after actually having, I think I was hanging out with Owen on that night, and I saw him, and he goes, I know you from Entertainment Tonight, because I'd done some stuff on Entertainment Tonight, and I don't remember, you know, the only thing I remember is we talked for a little while, it was really nice, and then Pat Patterson came up. That's why I said I thought he was nervous, because Pat Patterson came up and really was kind of embarrassing. You know, Pat Patterson caused it. You know, a scene would be too strong of a word, but it was really weird. So anyway, so that happened. And then as it turned out, later that night, we ended up, me, Brett, and Owen were, and I think it was one of my friends. I think it might have been my friend Joel, who was a friend of mine from college, who was actually who ended up being really good friends with Owen at that time. I think he was with us too, but that's what I remember about it. We were just talking about stuff, you know, all night, and, you know, I don't remember much else about it, really.
So I presume Patterson was not happy about you talking to Brett, or
no,
vice versa?
No, Patterson was not happy about Brett. It was more Brett talking to me, you know, and it wasn't even really his fault, because it was, you know, it was like actually the person who, you know, Brett was an innocent victim, and Patterson freaked out, but which is funny only because, you know, Patterson would always talk to me, you know, but it's that whole weird thing, you know, if anyone knew what was really going on there. I mean, there was one of the wrestlers figured it out. I thought it was really funny, you know, where just came up to me and just goes, I know that Vince is talking to you. And I go, yeah. You know, he goes, but he swears that he's not, and that no one's, you know, and you know, that you know, none of these guys, you can never talk to him, but he, you know, because how are you getting all that information? You know, it's just kind of funny.
All right, this person here says, is there any reason Hulk Hogan's colors in the 80s became yellow and red? He used different colors prior to settling on the yellow and red combo. I always thought it odd he never wore red, white, and blue with his pro-American personality.
I don't know. I don't really know what came into decision-making at that point.
All righty. This person here says, other than Jake, who would you say was the most over-heel to not get a run with Hogan during Hulk's first title reign?
Rick Rude.
That's right. Let's see here. Why do you think that was, by the way?
I don't know. I think that they thought that Rick Rude was too small to work with Hogan, as funny as that sounds, too thin. But Hogan worked with guys who were smaller.
He had a great physique, but he was thin by the standards of the time.
Yeah, I mean, if Rick Rude didn't do juice, he would have been 195 pounds at 6'4". So, you know what I mean? I mean, he was actually, like, naturally, like, really skinny. Because when he first went up there, I thought that, like, you know, this guy's not going to make it to being a big star there. Because, I mean, they'll never, you know, because they pushed so much based on body, and he was too thin. But he, you know, ended up being like 245 or some crazy, or 235 or something. But he was a lot bigger than he had been before when he was up there. So at that point, he really didn't look out of place at all. And he was phenomenal, I thought. You know, I mean, he had a great feud with Jake Roberts. That was one of the better programs of that time period. But it just, you know, I just think that they didn't take him seriously as that level of talent when he first came in. And then they, you know, had him in other programs where he lost, so Hogan probably didn't want to work with him at that point since he already lost and was always, you know, by their standards, not worthy of a title run. And then later when Warrior became champion, because Warrior and him had done the Intercontinental thing and he had actually beaten Warrior, I think he was the only one to beat Warrior because he beat him for the Intercontinental title before Warrior won the WWE title. You know, he actually did have a run with Warrior as champion, but he never had the run with Hogan. And Jake, I guess the story, you know, it depends on who you think, but, you know, I mean, they did the angle they did an angle that never aired on television where there were a lot of people chanting DDT, DDT when Jake ran him off. And then Hogan didn't want to work with Jake because I think he was afraid that, he would get booed or whatever it was, or Vince didn't want it. You know, I don't know. It could have easily been Vince, but they were going to do a Hulk Jake run. I mean, that one was planned. They shot the angle and then they nixed the whole thing. Whereas Rude, I mean, I could be forgetting something, but I don't remember ever being in that direction. And I never thought that they would because of, again, how they brought Rude in. They brought him in with other people and they had already beaten him before. It would have been the time, you know, before they realized that he was going to get over as big as he did. And it just wasn't the way that they would, you know, like when the time was going on, there was never this time of like, you know, why is he not working with Rude? But I think, you know, again, I mean, there might be other guys that I'm not thinking of, but that's the name that popped into my head as far as like a top heel that Hogan never had a big run with. There might have been a match here and there at a house show that I don't remember. But I just remember there was no big, you know, I never saw a Hogan-Rude match live. I know that.
All right, everybody, we're going to wrap it up for today, but I'm going to be back in the next couple of days. Wednesday, we may have a big guest on the show. We'll keep everybody updated on that on the front page. But new issue of Figure Four and Observer up in the next couple of days. We had two issues of the Observer last week. That's not counting the back issue. New back issue up tomorrow as well. So lots of stuff coming up, including a Figure Four Daily with Sammy Callahan. You can post your questions on the board for that. And we'll talk to you again after a while.